find it hard to say that everything is all right. Don't look at me that way, like everything is all right. 'Cause my own eyes can see
Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Lisa Adler, the production assistant for Voices from the Frontlines. For the next two shows, we will be bringing you some of our highlights of 2005. Today, we are going to start off with Eric Mann interviewing Carolyn Goodman, the mother of slain civil rights activist Andrew Goodman. Her son, along with James Chaney and Mickey Schwerner, was killed in Meridian, Mississippi in 1964 by the KKK. Eric interviews Carolyn shortly after the man who murdered her son, Edgar Ray Killen, is found guilty 40 years after committing the murder. For our second segment, we will have Manuel Criollo interviewing Richard Moore, director of the Southwest Network for Economic and Environmental Justice. He will reflect on the life of Chicano Liberation Movement leader Corky Gonzalez, who passed on April 12, 2005. And finally, we are going to end the show with Professor Dorothy Roberts talking about the right wing's assault on the reproductive rights of women of color. We hope you enjoyed today's 2005 greatest hits of Voices from the Frontlines, and we'll be right back with Eric Mann and Carolyn Goodman.
For what you fail to see is all the consequences. You think our lives are cheap.
I'm on the phone with Carolyn Goodman, civil rights activist for many, many years, the mother of Andrew Goodman, one of the Mississippi Three, with Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, Mickey Schwerner, just brought into the news, although it's been in the news in my mind every day since it happened, but the recent conviction in the case down in Mississippi. KKK member Edgar Ray Killen had been, what a name, had been convicted for the murder of three civil rights activists from CORE, and interestingly, which we'll discuss, convicted of manslaughter, not first-degree murder. Carolyn, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
It's quite all right. I'm happy to talk about it. In fact, I think it's very important that I do.
Well, why don't you start? Tell us, there's almost any place to start. Maybe we'll start at the trial and work backwards, if that's okay. Did you go to the trial yourself?
Yes, I certainly was there. I was there with my youngest son, David. And I was in Mississippi very recently. I just got back.
Okay. Why don't you tell us any thoughts about the trial? And I heard you on the CNN, of course, and Rita Bender and Ben Chaney,
yes.
James' brother.
Mm-hmm.
What were your observations? How strange? What was the jury like? What was it like going back into a Southern courtroom and having this thing played out for you?
Well, I will tell you that it was a stressful experience. I don't have to tell you that. But I will say that the people down in Mississippi were absolutely marvelous with, you know, outside of a person like Edgar Ray Killen, who was not easy to look at. But Rita Bender and the people such as Stan Dimon, who was the former editor of the show, Democrat, and Jerry Mitchell, who's the current editor, they were all there. And, you know, they were just so warm and caring. And it was hard to tell about the jury, but they were listening intently. And the district attorney and the attorney general were all marvelous people. I think they wanted to really come to some decision. And, you know, it really wasn't about people. It was about justice. And you know something? We waited a long time for this, and I think justice was done. And that was what it was all about. It was about justice.
When I was 62 right now, I was born 1941,
mm-hmm.
December 4th, and I was working in a settlement house. This is 1964. You know, a lot of people ask you, where were you when Kennedy died, which I know, but I also know, more importantly to me, is where were you then when they found out about Goodman, Schorner, and Cheney. Mm-hmm. And I was working in a settlement house in the South Bronx, and the person who about to go to work for CORE, and I was going to start with CORE in a few weeks when I heard about the three, quote, missing civil rights leaders. One of the things that, you know, historically we've always said is that because two of the three in this particular subset were white, that the system made so much more attention to it as opposed to even Medgar Evers or Emmett Till or, you know. But I want to sort of in a strange way say the opposite, which is I think it's pretty interesting that of the two white people, both were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think of that as a specific cultural subset of, like, how, tell us a little bit, if it's not too painful, about Andy and how he was brought up, what made him decide to go to Mississippi, what made him choose to go to CORE.
Mm-hmm.
Help people get back into a historical period that I think a lot of them don't understand right now.
Well, I think what a lot of people may not remember, that those were the times when the Jews were going into gas ovens in Germany.
That's right.
When they were being destroyed by Franco in Spain. And this was a time when radio, when television was in its early stages, when there was this, when Wallace was standing in the schoolhouse door and one little black girl was being, was stopped from going into the school because she was black and she was African American. And all this was something that Andy was brought up in a household where we talked about those things, where Andy was incensed by those things. And, you know, he was aware of all of that. And he was taught that this was a country where those kind of things shouldn't happen. And then when the volunteers were called for, he said to himself, you know, I can't believe this, that in this country, the African-American adults have to pay to vote. I mean, you know, this was absolutely an enigma to him. And he said, and then volunteers were called for, and he said to us, to his father and his mother, he said, I want to go and be part of that group of volunteers. Well, it wasn't easy for us, of course. But, you know, we couldn't talk about it and say it's terrible and say, well, let the others do it. That's not the way we were brought up. That's not the way he was brought up. That's not the way his grandfather taught his grandchildren. He said, if you believe in something, do it. Be part of it. Well, that's the story, really.
Well, when I was growing up, I was 6 years old, and I came up from the street, and I said, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch an end by the toe. And my mother said, what did you just say?
Yeah.
And I did not know what I had just said. I really didn't. And she said, don't you ever say that. Do you know that we're Jews? Do you know what Hitler did to us? Do you know what that word? No, my mom never got mad at me. And she said, you never, we are Jews and we fight for the Negroes. Do you understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Even in that tone of voice, like that scolding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Well, you sound like an echo of what I just said.
Yep, yep. Well, we're proud. I'm very proud. You know, I think about Andy all the time. I think of Mickey Schwerner all the time. I think of James Goodman all the time. And, you know, a lot of people went and fought in Vietnam and stuff. And a lot of, but they don't realize that for us, this was our going to war. On the, you know, I mean, this was joining the service.
And I'll tell you something. It's not over yet. It's not over yet because when I was in Mississippi, my son and the wife of Stan Dearman, who isn't all that well, went out to get a newspaper. And somebody, they went to the newsstand in this little town of, in Neshoba, in Meridian, and somebody gave them an envelope. And in this envelope, this is a very nice thing that happened, but I just want to tell you
Sure. What's
happening there. I have this right in front of me, and I'm going to read it to you. It said, this is a card, and in the card, it says the following. May the comfort and understanding of others help you through your sorrow, and time and cherished memories give you strength through each new tomorrow. And it's signed by a woman whose name is Claudia Goodman Rowland and family. And in it was a chain with a little plastic photograph of my son, Andy. and it said, "In loving memory of Andrew Goodman, indeed a good man, whose work helped improve the lives of others, June 21st, 1964. So you see, there are people who continue to think this way, and it's really wonderful. And, you know, that there are good people, because, you know, the news media tends to play up all the horrors that are going on. But the South has all kinds of people, and people who have risked their lives to create a better world in the South and in the North. And I live on the Upper West Side of New York City, and I can stand at the bus stop, and there are people who still push black people aside because they want to get a seat on the bus. You know, it happens everywhere. And what we have to, and I don't have a lot of time left, but I want to continue to work to make this a better world for my children. And I have, and I'm a great-great-grandmother. I'm 89 years old. I want to make it a better world to the extent that I can.
Well, this is Eric Mann, Voices from the Frontlines. We're on the phone with Carolyn Goodman, one of the heroes of the Civil Rights Movement, one of the many, many heroes of the Civil Rights Movement. Not just her son, Andy, but Carolyn. And we're talking about the recent trial in Mississippi, the conviction. I mean, one of the things that I think is important is that, you know, if you read W.E. Du Bois or if you read Manning Marable and all the different histories, Carolyn, the 60s was really the final end to slavery. I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't have racism, but Jim Crow and the plantation system and Fannie Lou Hamer being thrown off her own plantation by the head of the, you know, was a sharecropper and thrown off for voting and people being physically living in absolute terror 100 years later. We passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964 because the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment 100 years later didn't really mean very much.
Correct.
I saw you, I don't know if you remember, there was an interview with you in 1964. You were very courageous, and you showed this picture that you had done called Andy A.M., and it showed Andy in the lower part of the canvas because he was going to still grow. And you called it Andy A.M. because he was still in the morning of his life, but also A.M. stood for Anti-Meridian, Meridian, Mississippi.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, because what was it like being called upon? I mean, here you are grieving the loss of your own son, and yet being called upon to speak out at a time when I'm sure part of you just wanted to be left alone.
Well, you see, first of all, I should say that this painting was done by one of Andy's closest friends. And I have it to this moment. When I wake up in the morning, it's the first thing I see. And, you know, it really gives me a sense of strength. I don't grieve when I look at that picture because it's a painting of a beautiful young man who is, he didn't go south to die. He went south to live and to help others to live. And when I look at, that's a thought I have. And, you know, I feel that if people aren't willing to take a chance to risk to help others, they aren't living. And I'm willing to take chances because that's how I feel about life. I can remember when I was a little girl, I lived out in one of the outer boroughs of New York City. It was really the country then. And we had a man who my father loved to God. He was a lawyer. And this man was, you know, liked to grow. We grew some grapes and things like that. And he said, you know, during the time of Prohibition, he said, you know, could I take some of these home? I said, what do you mean, could you take them home? Of course, take them home. He said, well, your father's not going to like it. He said, well, I said, I don't care. You know, you're a worker. And, you know, I was only a kid then. I was about 8 or 9 years old. And if he gets angry, I'll take the blame. But you see, I didn't know what I was doing or what I was saying, but I sort of had a feeling that this man had a lot of children, and I didn't know what he was going to do with it, and I was pretty naive at the time. But I guess I sort of intuitively felt that a person who works hard for a living deserves whatever he gets in the way of goodies. And that's how I feel about life. You got to take a chance. And I guess I still feel that way. Because if you don't, you know, you might as well kind of stay in bed for the rest of your life and not do anything. And that's not my way of being.
Well, you know, there's a lot of discussion today of both religion and spirituality. It's hard sometimes for me to explain to people that this is our religion, this is our spirituality, that these are the moral choices, as you just said, the choice to risk your life in order to believe in life.
Yeah, but you don't really think, well, I shouldn't say you, I don't really think about it that way. I don't think I'm risking my life. I think I'm taking a chance on a better life for as many people as I can possibly reach. And I work with young people. I love young people because the future belongs to the youth. I mean, I don't want to leave this planet. I like it here. But, you know, but it is theirs. It's the young people. And I just, you know, and they call me and ask me questions, and I try to answer them to the best of my ability. And they say, well, look, Dr. G, that's what they call me. Look, Dr. G, you've lived a long time. What do you think? So I say, look, I'll answer the question, but it's not the end. You have to keep, you know, think for yourself and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not any paragon of virtue, but I do the best I can.
Well, absolutely. And this is Eric Mann. I'm on with Carolyn Goodman, the civil rights activist still to this day, the mother of Andrew Goodman, who was among the three civil rights activists killed in 1964, James Janey, Andy Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner. Let's go back to Mississippi a little bit. I mean, it is really amazing to think that if you think about the Scottsboro Boys in the 30s in Alabama, who, of course, were convicted, if you think about the virtual inability during the 60s to get a conviction on any kind of civil rights violation in Mississippi, what was the jury like? I mean, because part of the revolution that has happened is a jury of, what was it? I'm sorry, I should know, 12 or 13. It's 12, right?
Yeah.
What was the racial composition of the jury in this case?
In this particular
case? Yes, in the killing case.
Well, there were, as I, you know, like I say, I can't give you a positive. I do believe they were all white people. But, you know, it's a different place down there. It's different in Mississippi than it was back then in those other cases that you cite. So I think they, you know, they just felt that they were looking for a resolution. This has been going on for so many years.
I mean, isn't it fascinating that white people in Mississippi, I mean, when I was working with the MFDP and they were trying to prove that they were not an all-black party, but they were the future of the so-called Democratic Party. They were open to everyone, whereas the white party was closed. But we could barely get three or four white people to join the MFTP, you know, even though it was open to people of all races. And I think it is pretty incredible that either a predominantly or all-white jury did convict Killen at a time when, up until very recently, it was understood that, of course, he did it. But part of the white supremacy was to protect that level of murder. Did you get a chance to talk to a lot of people around the courthouse or go into coffee shops? And, you know, what was your life like for how long was the trial?
I tell you, the trial went on for about, the trial was more extended than the time that I was down there because actually someone had said, listen, I ought to go home. And I was told that my life was in danger. Because the Klan, while
today,
weaker than it was, was still after me. Because we had a driver whom I didn't know until I was on my way home because my son didn't want to frighten me. I was an ex-FBI agent, and he was assigned to drive us around, and he had a gun. And the media was all over, and he kept shooing them away because, you know, you never know who's around. So it's not a safe place for the likes of me, but I'm okay and I'm here and Like I said, I don't worry because, you know, worry can immobilize you too. And I feel I've just got to go on. And, you know, the future is in the hands of those people who care and in the hands of the young people. So, you know, there are always people who are looking to harm those who want to change the society and in their favor and who threaten the power structure. But that's the way it is, and it'll always be that way. And I don't think your audience should worry because you've got to be strong, and that's the way it is.
You were just listening to Carolyn Goodman, mother of slain civil rights activist Andrew Goodman.